This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And I'm delighted to be joined today by Eric Kaufman. Eric, thank you so much for your time.
Well, Peter, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
It's great to have you, and your name has popped up many times on my Twitter link, and we're going to go into White Shift, and I will point out how fantastic this book is, but you do need the time to read it because there's so much information historically and then bringing it up to the current day. But it's White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities, with so many endorsements on the back and inside. But before we get on to that, Eric, you're a professor of politics and you focus on national identity, I think has been the main focus. You're not a Brit. You come from Canada, over from Vancouver, and people can follow you. There is your Twitter handle, EPKAUFM. It is all there, and the links are all in the description. But Eric, maybe we can just start you giving us a little bit of introduction to yourself. How, as a Canadian, have you ended up being a professor here in the UK?
That's a good question. I mean, I came for a year, you know. It's I'd sort of, to some degree, didn't know what to do with myself, and I just thought, we'll do a year in London, you know, do a master's degree. And it was really never meant to be more than that. And even after that year, I then wound up doing a PhD because I got really interested in the subject. And my supervisor was kind of a leading authority on nationalism in the world. But even through that, I hadn't really thought, well, am I going to be a professor? And then even when I was towards the end going to be, say, okay, I'll try academia, I was applying, you know, everywhere, Canada, US, Britain, and just so happened that things worked out here. And then after a while, you get settled and your friends and everything, and then this is where I am over 25 years later.
Well, it's we benefit, of course, by your many, many writings and moving away, I think, from maybe the purely academic, more to the popular side, to bring some of these ideas out to the public. But maybe the first question, White Shift, it is a fantastically written book with such a background historically leading up to where we are now. I think I've read other books on populism and they've been quite dry. This actually is very easy to read, very engaging, interesting. But maybe I can ask you, it's a topic that maybe people fear to tread on because there's so many tags. There could be accusations, and we'll maybe touch on some of those later. I don't know whether it's brave to write something or more the foolish side, or why kind of delve down this? Because it's maybe safer within the academic sphere to discuss this, but you choose to take a step out into the public arena. Maybe let us know why you wanted to actually make that step.
Well, part of it is, you know, part of it is just as mundane as, you know, I've been in the academic world for 20 odd years, and, you know, you write things for other academics, which are read by a few people. And, you know, I mean, some books were read by more. But there's always, I think, a desire, at least on a certain section of academics, to communicate to a wider public. So that was certainly there. And I no longer generally publish with university presses who have a, you know, really a terrible distribution and promotion. Books are usually charged, you know, they usually charge £80 because their model is just to soak the libraries and then that's it. You know, they can make their money there. But no, I think that was sort of one motivation. But certainly in this topic, you know, I'd to some degree wanted to provide a, you know, more of a sort of detailed fact-based approach that you might get in academia, but then to sort of, you know, have an opinion as well. So both of those things are in the book. And I should say that in academia, you know, there are now tens of thousands of papers on the populist right. It's becoming a very, very walked on area. But the kinds of perspectives, they're almost always critical. And they have one, you know, overwhelmingly have one particular view, you know, that people are, I mean, there's maybe a couple of views. One is that it's just that people are badly off economically and that this is why they're voting for these parties. And really what they should be doing is voting for the left because that's their true interest. Or it's kind of down to, you know, the media and agitators have somehow seized hold of their minds and are pumping them with all this nefarious content. And that's why they're acting as they are. So it's all kind of a construction. Those are the kind of two dominant explanatory forces. Whereas if you were to say, well, actually, it is to do with pace of cultural and ethnic change that's real, and this is a real democratic response, that's going to be pretty unpopular in academia.
Did you have an interest in the political side? Because you can't really discuss the cultural change, democratic change, without actually connecting it to how does politics fit in, how do people vote? I mean, did you have a natural interest in that political side, or did that come into it as you were writing something like this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I am a political scientist, so I'm certainly marinated in that whole literature. And although I would say my own interests are more cultural, I would say that's sort of more my academic background. But as a political scientist, I've also had to take on a lot of these arguments around why do people vote as they do? You know, when do these issues actually translate into electoral shifts? So that then becomes a big part of the book as well, is to try and make sense of these upsurges of populism beginning 2014, although I think we're probably in line for another one. So, but that's kind of the... everyone was trying to explain, you know, Trump and Brexit and to some degree also Le Pen. And this was a way of kind of getting at that topic.
Hmm. Well, we'll get on, maybe touch on, I think there's probably going to be another shockwave in the European Parliament elections in May, but maybe we'll touch on that a little bit, but it doesn't really fully fit in. You start chapter one and you've got a century of white shift, and you give many examples. There were I found fantastic examples back from the 20s and 30s in the UK and also in the US. But people kind of think, well, the changes we've seen are kind of 10 years. You know, the culture wars, we've just seen this very recently. But you go back to delve into the historical basis and you kind of sit back and realize this isn't something that's just happened over 10 years, but actually it's been a change much further than that.
Well, that's right. And it's also the case that we've had episodes in the past that are very similar to the one we're facing. So, you know, the most successful third party movement in the United States was the American Party, or so-called Know-Nothing Party. And that was on the immigration issue, and it was Catholic immigration into a Protestant milieu. So you had the cultural and religious and ethnic change, and the speed of that was behind this movement. Similarly, if you go to, you know, if you look at the interwar Scottish Protestant League or Protestant Action in central Scotland, it was again a similar issue. And actually, I would even say, you know, if we're looking at Powellism, so much of what we're seeing now was encapsulated there, where you had a big disconnect between elite and mass. You had the immigration issue. And this was at a time, you know, when we didn't have social media, you know, you had industrial employment. So all these arguments about deindustrialization, all these arguments around people not being members of parties and churches and associations, I just think those are weaker arguments. When you look in the past, when you've had significant migration-led change, then you see significant, you know, national populist politics. So it seemed to me not much more complicated than that. I mean, it's not the only factor, but it just seems as though people don't really want to sort of seize that explanation. They want to look for something that's either economic or it's to do with the media, you know.
What was it that sparked, because the Brexit vote 2016, the book came out 2018, had you been putting pen to paper? Was it that event that made you kind of want to pull a lot of your writings together? What kind of was the catalyst?
Well, yeah, I guess it was a combination of Brexit and then the Trump vote. And, you know, I'd written blogs on both, essentially making the argument that it's not about the economy, it's not about the left behind. people who are don't have a job, don't have a, you know, lost their job, have a low income. I argued that was really not what was behind, overwhelmingly not what was behind these responses. But, you know, so if you looked at the Brexit vote, the surveys that I did showed it was about people who voted Brexit, about 40% of them, immigration was their top issue. And, you know, economic inequality was almost zero in terms of a top issue. So, yeah, that seemed to get quite a bit of traction. And I just also was then thinking, well, it's very interesting because when I wrote a book in 2004 on the U.S., and that was mainly looking at the history, the 19th and 20th century of immigration and national identity, the politics around that. And you had a few waves. You know, you had that 1890 to 1920 quite strong anti-Catholic populist wave, anti-immigration wave. And then they introduced a lot of these immigration restrictions. The issue went away for 40 years, and then they opened it up in the mid-60s. And then you slowly started to see, now it was a bit of a delayed effect, but you started to see in California in the 1980s and 90s, and then in Arizona in the sort of 2000s and 2010s, a lot of this sort of populism starting to occur again. But the question that I asked in 2004, and a number of us, Samuel Huntington amongst them, was it's very interesting that there hasn't been Le Pen-style populist backlash in America. Now, of course, it happened with Trump. It was, again, a delayed effect. But when I saw Trump, I was like, oh, yeah, I mean, this is obvious because it's been expected for quite some time. But everyone was acting surprised. And so that was another major factor in writing it.
And how, as a Canadian, did you look at? Because Canada, one of the chapters is about Canadian exceptionalism, and Canada's is quite different, maybe has been more liberal. And a lot of countries have that 50-50 where it's back and forward, right, left. Canada seems to maybe be more 60-40 or 70-30, has been more traditionally on the left. So how, simply as a Canadian, did you view what was happening, not over your border because you were here, but actually looking back, seeing that through Canadian spectacles?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting you ask that because right now all of that looks upside down with the... the Tories in Canada surging out front and the Labour Party surging out front here. So it's almost upside down. So, I mean, and I think things could be changing because the young population in Canada is about 50-50 and here they're about 6-1 left to right. So probably going to shift in the future. But if we just take the period up until now, you know, I think Canada, with the decline of the British Empire and the decline of loyalism, that was the basis of certainly the English Canadians who really formed like 2/3 of the country or 3/4 now. But that rationale for not, you know, we're not Americans because we remain with the British crown, that kind of went with the British Empire. And so you had this vacuum and it was filled by the left, and the left redefined, completely invented this new identity that Canada's this kinder, gentler, more left-wing country. I mean, it's largely a fabrication compared to the U.S. And then so that then creates a whole set series of dynamics. You know, you had the Multiculturalism Act. You've got more liberal immigration, a lot of these policies. Now, there is populism in Canada. You can certainly see it. The Reform Party in the 90s picked up on that and wipes out the Conservatives. So there's no question there is populism. Now, the question is it's starting to come back again, but it's been more delayed for a number of reasons. One is, you know, yeah, their historical attachments are weaker in Canada to founding fathers, to the history. Most Canadians, the English speakers, don't really have a clear historical narrative of who they are, especially not going back centuries. In the same way, I think the American narrative is more defined. You know, it's always contested. So I think because of weaker attachments, shallower attachments, that maybe weakens the capacity for national populism a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit. And then there's this question of political correctness, which has now kind of become wokeness. And I kind of think this is very important because, you know, you really have three aspects here. One is the demography, the ethnic changing, which is occurring at a certain rate in both countries, accelerating from the mid-60s. You then have this question of ideology and political correctness. So the left becomes dominant in certain ways in the meaning-making order in both countries, imposes this political correctness, which others kind of fall into line on. That then makes it very difficult to discuss immigration. Same thing's happening in Europe, by the way. And in fact, you know, one of the arguments of the book is we wouldn't have the rise of populism without political correctness, because political correctness means the mainstream parties can't touch this issue or address it satisfactorily the way they should in a democracy. And that opens up room for political entrepreneurs. So if you're only allowed to sell black pants in the government store, then the person selling blue jeans is going to be a black marketeer. And so if you're only allowed to sell pro-immigration policies, then someone who wants to talk about restriction like the Sweden Democrats, it'll be somebody from outside the system. And so you're empowering people from outside the system to essentially set up shop. And that's kind of what, so that's a big part of it. And Canada had has a very strong, one of the strongest political correctness regimes that's still standing. Few cracks are starting to appear, but and the way these things work is, you know, if you've got strong speech restrictions, that'll work until it fails. And when it fails, if it's been really strong, then the backlash effect is going to be pretty strong. So I think, and you can see in Germany and Sweden, you know, the strong political correctness lasted until the migrant crisis, which essentially broke it by allowing the populist right in. The center right then follows the populist right, breaks the taboos, and suddenly it's a new ballgame. It'll be interesting to watch Canada now. I mean, I wonder whether, you know, the gender issue might be the issue that breaks it. The immigration issue might be the issue that breaks it. Both of these things are now at sort of stress points that are kind of acute in Canada. So that it'll be one to watch. And there's no question, I think, that the, you know, the cratering of support for Justin Trudeau is related to a lot of these issues.
Yeah, I'm very happy to watch that cratering, but let's not get into my thoughts on it. The change of immigration, I mean, I know in the UK we saw a marked change in the numbers after Tony Blair came in, so 97, and we went from the 40, 50,000 up to the 100, 200, 500,000, and we've seen that change. How much does the change, how much is it politically orchestrated? Because migration has always happened. People have always moved from one place to another. But you always went from one place to another, and then where you went, there was a cultural identity, there was a national identity, there was something that made that country what it was. And we are seeing that change happen fairly rapidly. I mean, talking to that, the fast change, and it seems to be less natural maybe and more planned, although I don't want to go, I don't know how far down the rabbit hole I go on that or whether you'll pull me out of that. Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, how does it happen? Okay, I mean, if you just take the surge recently since the pandemic, you know what you had in Britain post-97 under Blair, you had a significant increase, you know, from about, as you say, about 50,000, which is where it really had been since the early 70s, net migration around that. And then suddenly, very quickly, within a few years, it's at 200, 250. And then under the Tories, it doesn't really fall. It arguably goes up again. And then certainly recently, it's really shot up. You know, obviously, you have global pressures. You have satellite TV, the internet and smartphones and everything like that. So people are more aware in the developing world. But it's not just, I don't think it's just that. I think there is a literature on migration. This is more illegal immigration, is that whenever a signal is given that there's a soft spot somewhere, it could have been, you know, in the U.S., there was the Mariel boat lift. In the 80s, you had, there was an indication given by, I think, by the American government. I'm trying to remember who was in office. It was the Democrats were in office. There was an indication given that they were just going to essentially roll out the welcome mat. And then you had a surge coming from Cuba in response to that signal. And so anytime there's a signal, it moves very quickly through the smugglers' networks, gets back very quickly. And now's the time to move, get your stuff together. So That's on the illegal front, but I think something similar on the legal front, where if a place is seen as a soft touch, then that'll stimulate more demand. And I think to some degree that's been happening. What else has been happening? I think certainly if you look at the Tories recently, the people who have been in charge of the Conservative Party, including of the Brexit movement, by the way, the mainstream Brexit movement, have been liberal Tories who are mainly motivated by economics. And so they are the ones who've been in control. And again, including the Brexit movement, and that's people like Dominic Cummings, who said, we're not going to be about immigration. We're going to be about deliberately acting as a rule taker that, yes, to talk about immigration is racist and makes you a bad person. You know, so they essentially have bought into that. And then, of course, you've got pressures from business, lobbyists, the NHS, various other places that just want more workers at a low price. And unless you are committed to delivering the will of the people on numerical reduction, they had convinced themselves that, you know, some of these progressive academics, and some of whom I know, love to sort of come up with this argument, well, it's just about control. If people feel they have control, then they'll be happy with high numbers. That's sort of the argument they wanted to push. And it's the argument that a lot in government eagerly wanted to believe. But that also tells you that they are not on the same page as their voters, because their voters, 90% want less, substantially less immigration. And so clearly the MPs are coming from a different background and are not as motivated by this issue as their voters. And so there's a disconnect there. And now, of course, the chickens are coming home to roost as people come to realize, just because they said they're in favor of Brexit doesn't mean they're in favor of Brexit for the same reason that we were in favor of Brexit. It's for them, it's just making Britain a global free trading state. It's not about sort of controlling the pace of cultural change. So that's sort of a major kind of dissonance that's occurred. But yeah, that's how I'd explain the rise, really. It's a combination of, yes, there's the demography, but that's kind of a constant. I think it's largely to do with domestic factors and particularly the prioritization of other things over migration control.
Can I ask you where, because you do a really well job in the book of setting out the situation without it being an opinion piece. If I delve into this, it would be a full-on opinion piece, which doesn't necessarily help. And you hold off extremely well on letting the reader put the pieces together and make their own mind up. I mean, tell us how negative, and you've got left and right, full-on unfettered immigration is positive, or no, this is extremely destructive. How do you see where we are in terms of how positive this is or how negative it is?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. Like in the book, I was trying to explain the rise of national populism, trying to explain that the cultural left has had a major role alongside, obviously, the neoliberal business right in opening borders. And yeah, my own view is essentially that I tend to take a more culturalist view, which is that the most important reason people want less immigration is cultural, not economic. And that essentially there's an optimal level of diversity. Diversity is not something to be maximized. It's something to be optimized, and you have to have a balance. And it takes probably 2, 3, 4 generations to really properly assimilate. That's assuming that, essentially assimilate groups. That's what happened even in the U.S. with the white European Catholic Jewish groups. It took that long for the ethnic neighborhoods to break down, intermarriage to become large scale. And so when you've had a sort of period of fast immigration, I think you really need to slow it right down and allow that assimilation to occur. So I'm generally in favor of a sort of immigration pause, build up social cohesion, increase trust again in the society, to increase trust in the democracy that people are being listened to. That's sort of that's kind of my take on it. I'm not in favor of zero immigration, but I think it's got to be brought more down to the levels that were common prior to 97, let's say in Britain, just to allow for some of that to occur. Otherwise, you get this, what Robert Putnam would call this kind of hunkering down, very thin, thin-bounded, weak-tie type society, which is very susceptible to polarization of various kinds and low trust of various kinds. And I just don't think it's the way forward. I also argue that there's kind of ethnic majorities help stabilize nation states as well. Again, reduce polarization, increase democratic legitimacy, and you need time for the assimilation process to work, to I think, maintain a significant sized ethnic majority presence. I don't believe as much in the sort of polycentric, multi-ethnic, you know, places like, you know, Guyana, Trinidad, Kenya, Tanzania. I mean, there's in a lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that are that don't have an ethnic majority, where you actually have just a series of coalitions of minority groups, and there's quite a lot of instability, and it's mainly ethnic voting patterns. I just don't think that's kind of really a, you know, a recipe for. It's not necessarily going to lapse into civil war, but it's just not a recipe for the most successful societies.
It is part of the problem, a lack of confidence in identity. I mean, I've lived in over in Eastern Europe for years, and it's interesting how you see the move. The further east you go, the more confident and the more nationalistic in a love of nation, a love of culture, a love of country. The further west you go, that seems to have been abandoned, and actually even seen it more in the US, where you have this rise of self-hate and rewriting of history. Is that part of the problem? Because once you put, and often the immigration comes from cultures that are still very strong on holding on, African or Middle Eastern, they often bring their culture and identity with them. Is that one of the massive issues that we are seeing when you drop a strong identity into a vacuum?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point about the sort of vacuum there. I mean, that's been a long process of almost a century, but accelerating, of kind of a self-hatred, a kind of what Roger Scruton would call oikophobia, that's been developing amongst particularly the intellectual class, to some degree the highly educated, not all of them, but it's just more prevalent amongst them, this notion that they are not, they have nothing in common with those of less education, lower class, and to the nation, and really they're just an individual in a lifestyle enclave, which is kind of a global thing. Yeah, that has sort of become more and more prevalent. And so the tendency to attack your own group, you know, I'm just thinking about what's a good survey question, you know, people saying, you know, the United States is a racist country. Some surveys are showing 50-55% on that measure. Again, heavily, you know, in Britain, it's like 40%. You know, it depends, obviously, who you got in your sample. Those are probably slight overstatements. But if you were to go on to the left of the political spectrum, you're getting very high levels of support for that kind of contention. And so foregrounding the negatives in your society instead of the positives is, it's kind of like an autoimmune disease. So you need to have some self-criticism, you know, and maybe you could argue maybe that parts of Eastern Europe, it's too far the other way. You know, you need to, you know, you do want to obviously admit where you've gone wrong so that you can do better. But on the other hand, what you need to be leading with is the achievements, the positive. It's a bit like me as an individual. I might have, you know, stolen a chocolate bar at age 10 somewhere. Is that going to be in the forefront of my mind every morning? it's a recipe for mental illness and for incapacity, right? So it's just a terrible way to run your society. And yet if that's what the schools are just emphasizing, you know, Black History Month, you know, Indigenous reconciliation, blah, 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 everything's about shame, shame, shame. I mean, that is certainly the way it's going. How can you expect, you know, the society to cohere and do things together? So that tendency has just become stronger and stronger and stronger. You know, you need a little bit of it, but we way overshot for a number of decades at least. And so the battle right now, and I think Douglas Murray in his book, The War on the West, kind of states it pretty baldly. I mean, really, we have to find some way of kind of rolling back the dominance of the progressive element in the teaching profession and reforming the schools. The battles over critical race theory in schools in the U.S. are an example of an attempt to start to do that. That needs to be given a lot more attention, I think. Now, in terms of the other cultures coming in, I mean, I don't really blame them. They have their identities. That's fine. I think the problem is really the host society has just been too much focused on sensitivities of minority groups. You want to have some sensitivity, but you really got to watch it. You can't have too much sensitivity because you have to think about the majority as well and its rights. It's about balancing of rights. And we have to expect, yes, we want to be sensitive, but on the other hand, minorities, we also need some resilience there, that this is an established culture. It needs respect. You know, you can certainly have your own version of what it means to be British. That's fine. But and it's not really them doing it anyway. I mean, it's really the white progressives that are beating up on their own country and driving the narrative. And somehow we need to find a way of reining in the cultural power of the progressive left. That's a problem across all Western countries, I think.
Mm. And of course, we have those European parliamentary elections coming up in May, and it looks like there's going to be a massive shift in the European Parliament over to the right, with a lot of those populist parties coming first. And the response seems to be from those in office to ban. I mean, look at what's happening in Germany, and they're trying to ban the AfD from running. But then also, I mean, you mentioned some countries there, Canada. Well, I'll just leave that. But if you look at Europe, at Portugal, Spain, you mentioned two countries back in 2018 that didn't really have a populist rise. I think Portugal have got elections just coming up, and Czech party are going to do very well on the right, a new party. And then the Vox party in Spain, I think they've got around 15 or 18% of the vote as well. So there seems to be a wakening up and a pushback. And this seems to be because, and similar to the Brexit vote, I think, if you call the electorate stupid enough, if you tell them, no, this isn't happening, and they see it on the immigration and on the woke, then there will be a backlash. I mean, how do you think that's going to work out? Because still our governments are refusing to accept, and the response is, we know better, you don't. Just keep quiet and let us continue doing what we are doing. But that will be, I think, a big change in May and those elections.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth saying that immigration is absolutely at the center of this. Now, you can say certainly that some countries like the Czech Republic don't have much immigration, and Hungary doesn't have much immigration. So that's a fair. So some people will say, well, look, you know, this populism is very strong in places that have fewer immigrants. Eastern Germany maybe has fewer than Western Germany, and all of, you know, this is an argument that's made sometimes. I'm not saying that immigration is the only factor. Clearly, the Eastern European cultural substrate and experience with history of being invaded and losing rights, it's a different experience. But I would say one other thing, which is that it's not East European countries outside the EU that have national populism. It's East European countries inside the EU, which are therefore potentially subject to obligations to take refugees and to immigration flows. They're exposed in a way that East European countries outside, like obviously Ukraine would be one, but I mean, if you take Belarus or some of these other, going down into the former Yugoslavia, Serbia, and so on, these places don't have the same dynamic. So it is still about the migration issue, even in those Central European countries. Now, in terms of woke, you know, so I don't think that this issue on its own is yet moving the dial very much in elections. If you ask voters, a whole series of issues around woke, like critical race, radical gender ideology in schools, for example, or racial quotas and hiring, none of that stuff is really registering yet in the way it's registering in the United States. Now, there are a few exceptions, and we saw the Isla Bryson episode in Scotland made a difference. So I think it will gain, I think it's going to gain priority in the years ahead. But what's mainly happening is it's mattering, but it's mattering indirectly, because it's mattering in the sense that elites are constrained, will not tell a straight truth, or will not sort of say, well, we're going to commit to reducing numbers and you can hold us to that. there's a desire still to say that's a little bit of a topic that polite society avoids and you shouldn't be talking about it. And if you are going to talk about it, you can only talk about it economically. I mean, I think that that just means that these parties are not able to minister to the desires of their constituents, and so they're going to be punished. And that's really what I think the results are going to be showing us. And the results in Europe, the results in America, and the results in Britain are all going to be reflections in some ways of that process of an indirect effect, whereby woke kind of shuts down debate. That means politicians aren't getting on top of immigration, which means the populists have an opportunity. So, yeah, we should expect, I mean, obviously we've seen Meloni in Italy already in power. But, you know, the Wilders vote, you know, he topped the poll in the Netherlands. The AfD are doing very well. A lot of the populist right parties are really doing well. And that's on the back of renewed migration numbers, particularly crossing the Mediterranean. So I think that would be my prediction. I think it's really a straight up issue of, and what I show in the book really is that it's not so much that people who wanted less immigration suddenly say, oh no, or who wanted more suddenly say they want less. It's that people who already are, for ideological reasons, committed to reducing numbers, when the immigration numbers go up, immigration rises as a priority from issue number 5 to issue number 1. And so now amongst Tory voters, it's in this country, for example, it's the number one issue.
I think you did about 8 or 10 pages to the conflict over definition of racism. And in one of the chapter 8, you actually go through a chart. And that's the chart there, looking at values, looking at whether people see certain things as racist, looking at the Democrat-Republican vote and then the overall difference between the two of them, whether building a wall on the Mexican border is racist or not. 70% of those voting Clinton said, yes, building a wall on your border is racist, to all the way going where there is actually very little difference, wanting separate part of country for own race, where 90% agree, you know, that is racist. But this term is used as a label to shut down the conversation. But then, yeah, I look at some of those questions and think, is having a border racist? And obviously many people say a border is racist.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I think particularly the, you know, the white Democrats, the liberal left of the American spectrum, but not just the American, but also in other Western countries, has kind of gone off the rails. The inflation in the meaning of the term racism or white supremacy, and a number of these terms, has really taken off in the 2010s, what's known as the Great Awakening. And so, you know, you saw, for example, in the U.S., the number of people saying racism was a very big problem in America kind of went from 35% amongst white liberals to 85% within five, 10 years. If you look at the content of the New York Times, Washington Post, the use of racism and white supremacy just explodes. And that is really kind of what ties in and more or less explains this increase in perception. Actual racism was going down in by any sort of sensible metrics around, you know, police use of violence, interracial marriage, survey questions. In any kind of sensible measure, you know, racism in the U.S. is actually in decline. But people are saying it's increased, if that is at least if you're on the left. So I think what this, and similarly, if we talk about the border, I think what this reflects is just a concept creep and a kind of inflation in the meaning of terms. And it's also useful, of course, because the term, you know, racism is a taboo. It's a kind of, as John McWhorter says, it's sort of social death. So it's a very useful weapon if you want to, you know, shut people down or ruin people's reputation. And therefore, it's just something that's irresistible for people to say, oh, you want to build a wall on the southern border. Well, that's because you hate brown people and that's racism. Well, no, that's actually not the main motivation. But this just shows the kind of immaturity and the dishonesty around the use of this term and the tendency to inflate it, which is really a core component of wokeness. I mean, really what wokeness is about is making minorities sacred, and therefore anything that might conceivably offend the most sensitive, imaginable individual, like building a wall, must be ipso facto racist, right? And that's kind of where we're at. So just paralyzes debate, leads to polarization. But unfortunately, this is the trend because a lot of people are just completely suckered in by this piece of kryptonite, you know, that they worship. And as soon as you mention race and racism, you know, they just bow and genuflect.
You divide the book into four parts. You've got fight, part one, repress, part two, and flee, part three, and join, part four. And we've looked a lot on the fight aspect. What about the repress? I mean, in it, you talk about left-wing populism v. right-wing populism. You say left modernism versus the populist right. Tell us about that, the repress chapter. What did you want to kind of bring out in that section?
So, yeah, I mean, fight is really about, you know, resistance to immigration through voting for populists. Pretty simple. The repressed side is really about political correctness or wokeness now and how that leads people to kind of repress whatever anxieties they have. And, you know, a good example of that is probably in the flee section of the book where what you notice is that whites who are progressive and whites who are conservative tend to both migrate from diverse areas towards white areas at similar rates. So in terms of putting their, you know, in terms of sort of walking the walk, let's say, there's no question that the white liberals are not walking the walk when it comes to diversity. They are saying they love diversity and they are betraying their kind of revealed preferences by sort of moving to relatively homogenous areas. And you'll see, you know, it's the enclaves of cities that are known as the left-wing enclaves tend to be relatively white. In you know, I'm just thinking of certain places. In Vancouver is an area called Kitsilano. It's the kind of hippie area. It's like probably the whitest part of, you know, downtown Vancouver. I mean, and that's an example of what I'm talking about. It's just that there is this, so there's a lot of suppression and fooling of oneself going on here as a result of this belief system, which is essentially one that says diversity is fantastic. Minorities are more morally, spiritually deeper and more interesting and superior in many ways to whites who are kind of the fallen, the guilty. That's the belief system. And I just think, therefore, that leads to the suppression of any sorts of, you know, ethnic or national sentiment. So the correct pose is to be against your group, to run it down, and to praise minority groups, because that just shows that you're enlightened and you're also moral. And that's kind of what we're reckoning with, is this cultural version of the left. And I think it's not just about cultural Marxism. You know, some would say, well, this is just the idea of the oppressor oppressed, taken instead of bourgeoisie and working class, it's now people of color versus the whites, and it's just been transposed. It certainly has been transposed by a significant group of radical leftists, but it's also, I would argue that the liberal left is the bigger actor in this, and that they have fallen under the spell of the racism taboo, and then subsequently taboos over sexism and homophobia and transphobia. These identity-based taboos now define what they think is a good person, and that their main goal has to be to demonstrate all the time that they are an ally, they are not racist, and do what Shelby Steele calls dissociating themselves from the bad whites. So they're the good whites. And that's their identity. It's guilt-based, to some degree, bleeding heart, compassion-based, but it's always about this inversion of, let's just say, normal ethnic or national identity on their own behalf. So yeah, that's kind of what I mean by repression is, and even for people who are not paid up woke, I think there is still, again, because of the power of this taboo, which even a wider section of society accepts, it's just seen as a bit dubious. If you express any misgivings over immigration or multiculturalism, you are suspect. And again, so you repress that. You keep it to yourself. Again, this is all part of this self-censorship, which I think comes out of the dominance of this moral order.
I want to just end off on the flee section, but I thought is a lot of the immigration is from more socially conservative countries and areas. And it's interesting where maybe there would be different views, but actually on a lot of the cultural issues, it would be similar, whether it's from a Christian culture in many parts of Africa or an Islamic culture in parts of the Middle East. There is that social conservative. I think in America, they're finding that with the Hispanic vote and actually the Black vote for Trump prior to the election being very high because they are natural bedfellows. How do you see that? Is that something that the left haven't bet on, that that's going to surprise it? Because that would seem to bring the whole thing collapsing down when those who come to the country actually say, yes, actually, we want these values. Mm-hmm. And that's a clash between many of our governments in the West.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, this is kind of some of the contradictions in the kind of rainbow coalition of racial, sexual minorities that the left is assembling in many Western countries. The left, of course, has moved away from its traditional white industrial working class base towards the college university towns and the highly educated, but also trying to appeal to a number of immigrant groups. You know, you've seen in a number of countries, Canada and the U.S. in particular, the gender ideology stuff, the people protesting that, Muslims taking a major role in terms of Muslim parents. You know, that's one angle. You know, in the U.S., you had the anti-same-sex marriage California Prop 8, which passed in, I think it was 2008. Support from Hispanics was quite high on that. And so you can see that the sort of sexual feminism side of the identity left and the more multicultural race religion side are kind of in conflict. Now, of course, as you say, what's happened in the U.S. actually is that the particularly Hispanics, to some degree Asians and Blacks, are not just socially conservative on the family value stuff, which to some degree was accepted, but what we're now seeing is they're actually conservative on immigration and the border, partly because of where they live, partly perhaps because they're competing with these people. One of the interesting things I found in the book when I looked at Asian and Hispanic Trump voters, they were just as likely as white Trump voters to agree with statements like this one, whites are under attack in America, or it's important to preserve and protect the European Christian heritage of America. Or I think white European Christian, I mean, a majority of Hispanic and Asian Trump voters are agreed with that statement. If you look on immigration, there's a lot of resentment in border communities that have a high Hispanic share. So, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. The latest couple of New York Times Siena poll, one came out yesterday, which showed that there was no difference now between Hispanics and whites in their tilt to Trump. You know, what I would say is that, yeah, there's no way that could have been predicted. The problem for the Democrats is they had assumed that as the Hispanic population increased as a proportion, there'd be this natural built-in Democrat majority. What they hadn't figured on was this switching away, and that has really damaged them. And this is one of the reasons I think Trump is, unless he really screws it up, I think he is very likely, he's got a very strong chance of winning, is because most of the white population is already polarized into one camp or the other. The minority population is more of a swing vote and has been moving towards the Republicans every election since 2008 by a few points. And they're in, you know, states like Nevada and Arizona, they're going to be an important swing constituency. And if they've now moved by X number of points since 2016, then, or since 2020, I think that'll be enough really to tilt this thing, even without disillusionment with Biden. I think it's a very significant development, quite interesting.
Our time is up. Just for a very last point, and it's a massive one. Just your few thoughts just on the flea side, because we're seeing big change. We are seeing more and more America becoming two states becoming quite a separate country. And here in obviously in the cities, we are seeing that white flight with London, Birmingham being completely different to what they were 30 years ago, I think across Europe as well. I mean, is something like that reversible? Is that the natural where we're going? I mean, living in London for 22 years as someone born in Ireland and not even going to the sectarianism in Ireland, but just coming to London and wanting to come to somewhere that was English because I thought I lived in England, I could find that, and realizing actually London is not an English city at all. What are your thoughts on that? Is it possible for that to actually go back, or is this simply where we are going as societies?
I think it is where we're going as societies, because when you, I mean, you can be like Singapore and you can centrally determine who gets to live where, and then you can engineer the segregation out of the system. But as long as people have a choice, the kind of pattern you find is, you know, you'll get a lot of progressive academics saying, oh, well, you know, our segregation indices show no change, or if anything, even a slight decline in segregation. So there's no problem. What does that actually mask? What it masks is two things. So yes, ethnic minorities are moving out of their initial concentration areas, like Bangladeshis in the east end of London, Tower Hamlets have been moving out into Redbridge and these other areas. That's true towards outer London. So you get minorities moving out of their areas as their numbers are expanding and they get somewhat increase in prosperity, they move out. So you could say that's a decrease in segregation. But then on the other hand, what you have is the white British population consolidating towards areas where that are already heavily white British. And so I'd say something like 80% of wards in England are 90% white, roughly. I mean, those are the kinds of places where white British people are either not leaving or are they moving towards. And this is the same graph in Canada and the US and Britain. If you graph the, let's say in 2011, what share of a ward, it doesn't matter which geographic unit you use, ward, local authority, what share is white British in 2011? And then you take the change between 2011 and 21 in the total white British population in that particular area. What you see essentially is that it is the areas that are relatively white that retain white population far more, whereas the areas that are diverse become diverse at a quicker and quicker and quicker rate. So the Brents of this world, you know, I'm trying to think of, I mean, there are different parts of London, Tooting, there's parts of the East End, you know, places that are already heavily diverse. Whites are not moving there. And they may move there if they are very centrally located to central London, like Brixton, for example. They will not move there if it is out in Stratford somewhere. And it's yeah. So it's Newham, some of these areas that are further out are just not going to receive. Luton would be another area. These areas are just going to become more and more or less and less white over time until there is a minimal white presence, maybe a few senior citizens, but certainly in terms of new movers, people will avoid. And this kind of white avoidance pattern, we see it in Sweden as well, in Netherlands as well. What that essentially means is you are getting minorities kind of spreading out, but you're getting whites consolidating, and the two are balancing each other's off. So it looks like, oh, yeah, it looks like segregation is not doing anything, but in reality, it is. And so that is just something, and I have a number of chapters on that of different countries in the book. And that's to say we are getting a white avoidance phenomenon going on everywhere. And that's not really talked about seriously as one of the results of this growing diversification. The other thing, by the way, you get is what Robert Putnam talks about, is that people's social networks, you know, even if you do live in a diverse area, the more diverse an area, the more socially segregated, particularly the whites, are in those diverse areas. They are in a kind of a bubble, and their friendship networks are so out of kilter with the demographics of the areas they live in. And so whereas it's the sort of relatively white areas where whites would tend to have a friendship pattern that looks more like the community they're from. So there will be some minorities in that friendship pattern. And there'll be some minorities in the community, and it will be a fair representation. But once we get into the big urban areas and the diverse areas, they're just, it's a lot of social, what Putnam would call hunkering down, people withdrawing really from communal life and from attachment in many ways to their communities.
Eric, I really appreciate your time. Alho, that is the book, White Shift. It is a fantastic book, and I would encourage everyone watching, or if you're listening on our podcast platforms, do get a copy of it. You'll not be disappointed. I challenge you to buy it and email me to complain that you didn't like it, because you will not be able to. Eric, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on and sharing your thoughts on a massive subject. So thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list. Donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.